This is Kenai Garden Talk on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. It's harvest time on the Central Kenai Peninsula, but what to do with all that garden goodness? On today's show, we'll turn flowers into food. We'll tour the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank to see how they share the fruits and vegetables of their volunteer labor. And we'll grill local chef Willow King for a quick and easy preparation for fresh local produce. But first, don't let pests get the best of your garden. The Cooperative Extension Service shares tips for warding off bugs, slugs, and other garden problems. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. You might not think slugs can move quickly, but if you don't stay ahead of them, they can damage plants faster than you may realize. Casey Matney is the Agriculture and Horticulture Agent at the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service on the Central Kenai Peninsula. If you've got garden pest questions, he is not sluggish with answers. We met in Soldotna Creek Park recently to talk about solutions for slugs and other garden thugs. Do you want to go check and see if we can find some slugs over by the flowers?
Yeah, let's go check. There we go.
Oh, there's one.
There's actually several. See them hanging out together? There's one, two, three.
Yeah, convention.
Yeah, it's just tons of them in here.
Oh, yeah.
So they're just in here eating leaves and stems off of these dandelion, then venturing out. So these guys, even though this isn't a spot where we're going to be growing vegetables and having a significant flower garden, these slugs are out here in the environment living in the grass and the flowers. Best way to know if you've got slugs there is to lay down a piece of wood or a piece of cardboard and it'll...
If you have them, they will come.
They will show up. What they do is they like to hang out in the evenings, the mornings, and then at nighttime, they go through all the vegetation when it's nice and humid. And the ideal time for them would be if it's like 90%, 100% humidity and almost no wind.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the day comes and the sun pops out and the wind picks up, then they start to hide. But they leave behind tons and tons of eggs. And that's one of the biggest issues, not only for gardeners, is this year's slugs, but also all of the eggs they're leaving for next year.
Have you heard there being much of a problem this year?
There's a lot of slugs this year. I actually had just a small piece of cardboard I got over by my garbage can that was left on the ground for a few days. I rolled it over to throw it away, and it was just covered in slug eggs. Just completely covered in these little, you know, you would say little brown oval shaped, egg shaped, little slug eggs, about the size of a pencil lead, maybe slightly larger. But there's lots of eggs right now, and they don't have to be very big to cause lots of damage. So anywhere from a quarter inch long to an inch long is what most of our slugs are going to look like. And they can go through and they can eat up your lettuce, your cabbage, whatever they can find. So there's a lot of them this year, but it's mostly because we've had a lot of cooler temperatures. We had a little bit slower to go summer that we had, and then it's this humidity we've had. We've had keep getting shots of rain every few days, so that's keeping them going. So if it was drier, like we had a summer or two ago, mm-hmm. when it was warmer and drier, there wasn't as many slugs. Until the rain started to come in July, and in August things started to cool back down, you started to see them more.
Is there a constant number of slugs and they come out more when it is wet, or do they hatch more when it is wet and there's more slugs?
So the way the slugs work is they're actually hermaphrodites. So they start out as males and then they go through maturation and then they become females later. And so they're all capable of producing eggs. They roam around on the ground and they're eating constantly. They leave trails. If you were able to take their speed, they can go up to about 6.5 inches a minute. Like if you look at one of the large banana slugs.
Really?
The average slug will travel anywhere from about 30 to 40 feet per night.
You would not think that to be the case.
Yep, they're constantly eating and constantly moving. So even if you were to, you know, send a kid outside with a little box of salt or a little shaker of salt, they would be chasing them down constantly because they're always moving.
So as much fun as that science experiment is for kids, is that the recommended method, or what do you tell people if they're having slug problems?
Yeah, I mean, salt would work fine if you're like on your patio deck or like a walkway or out on your lawn, just a little bit. But what if you want to do, if you've got a lot of them and you've got a garden area, you can use a spray of one part ammonia and 9 parts water.
Okay.
And that will attack their membranes and they won't survive for very long that way. And what happens is the ammonia breaks down and just releases nitrogen into the environment. So it actually acts as a little bit of a fertilizer.
Oh, so, nice. Yeah, it's a pretty dilute solution.
Yeah, so that works as a pretty benign chemical that's considered basically kind of organic that you can spray. That's the other things you can use, they call it metaldehyde, and it uses heavy metals. And it can be used as a slug bait, and it stops them from being able to produce the mucus that they use for their membranes to keep them moist, to protect them while they're out, because they don't have a shell. That's not one of the ones we typically recommend. One of the ones you can get at the store, it's called Sluggo. It's an iron phosphate, and so they can ingest that, and then that will kill the slugs, and that's a slug bait.
And is that like a granular thing that you put out? Or?
Yeah, yep, yep. And then you can put that the Sluggo out. Then also people will do traps. So there's two types of different traps. Trap that will trap and kill. That's basically if you take one of the most common traps is a beer bait trap.
I have heard of that. I'm skeptical at wasting beer on slugs, but...
Yeah, so if maybe unfinished, undrank beer, that's not something you're going to drink anymore. And then what they'll do is they'll take like a cottage cheese container, dig it down into the soil to bury that about a couple inches into the soil, pour some beer into that. You could also use a water bottle or something like that that's left over. And you can cut a hole in the side of the plastic to create an entrance into that slug bait. And they'll go into it and they'll fall into it and they won't be able to get out. That's the catch and kill way. The other way is to lay out pieces of mulch or fabric or wood. Wood works really good. So if you've got old lumber or cardboard, works really good, and you can flip that over in the mornings, and then you'll see lots of slugs crawling around. You also see slug eggs, and so you can go along and smash them yourself. Or if you have ducks or chickens, if you just had them walk behind you, which they will do as soon as you're flipping over wood, they'll eat the slugs as soon as you expose them.
Something eats everything, I guess.
Yep, ducks especially.
And if you're doing the trap method, it doesn't sound like the most recommended, but is that addressing the eggs that they're leaving behind? Is there anything you can do for that?
So for their eggs, they usually leave them within about 5 inches of the soil surface. And the slugs will actually bury down into cracks in the soil and things like that, and they'll lay the eggs down in the soil. Those eggs, if throughout the growing season, they lay them early in the season, they will hatch this year. And they can roam around and eat, and then they'll lay some more eggs. But the ones we're worried about for next year are the ones that are laid before basically October, before the slugs start to hide and die and disappear. So those eggs hold over in the soil. Okay. Then they'll appear in the spring after we start to experience a warm-up in temperatures, especially in May.
If slugs are laying eggs throughout the summer, do those then hatch too, or do those all overwinter?
Yeah, some of those will hatch. A lot of those will hatch if they early on in the season. Okay. So those larger slugs that you see now would have already laid eggs. The very small ones you see are probably this year's slugs that have come up and are just hatched. But they will also be laying eggs as soon as they start to mature.
So you really want to get a handle on this as early as possible.
Yeah, and so if you can, you want to catch all your slugs early on, so you're stopping the slugs from reproducing the season, but also catching any of the eggs before they're actually deposited everywhere. Then what you want to do is make sure you keep that up, and if you do know an area has slugs, you want to go in, and you can work the soil or till it. If you get the eggs too far down in the soil, and you basically turn the soil over, or if you expose it to more arid environment where it's not moist anymore, protected in the soil, that will kill the eggs too.
Are there certain types of plants or garden environments? I mean, wet, obviously, but are there other things that attract them more than not?
Basically, your garden is your their perfect place to be.
Of course.
So any of your softer and leafier vegetation, whether it's your ornamental type garden, things like lettuce and cabbage, even roses can attract slugs. But if you get into things that have more chemicals in it, so things like onion and other types of plants that kind of have a way of repelling other types of things from eating them, then you don't have to worry about those as much. But all of that soil area, wherever there's an area for them to hide, especially areas like where we're standing at here, where there's vegetative cover above, even when the sun does come up, it stays humid and moist underneath. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a spot that will hold them over, and then they'll use that to travel again. So if you imagine them traveling 40 feet at night, then using a refuge that's further away from where they started, and then the next day they start their trail, and then the evening again. And they'll feed throughout the day in areas that are covered, so if you have lots of leaf lettuce grown close together, they'll still be feeding underneath during the day.
So keeping your garden weeded and your soil tilled throughout the year is probably a good way to help cut down on that.
That's definitely a good way to do it.
Or else go to your neighbor and plant a bunch of junk in there so the slugs hang out there.
Yeah, and then also, you know, you can use copper strips. People will use copper around the outside of their beds. They'll use old copper pipe and they'll tack it to the tops of their raised beds on the wood around the side. And that kind of acts as a barrier to keep slugs from coming in. The unfortunate thing is if you've already got slugs inside, you've basically created your own little Jurassic Park of slugs on the inside.
So if you're looking at your plants and you're seeing that something's been chewing on them, how do you know it's slugs versus something else?
If you're looking at the plants and you see large clean-cut holes, and so this is a dandelion, and we've seen larger clean-cut holes, you look for something like that, especially if it's gnawed in from the margins. That will be pretty good evidence of slugs. The telltale sign of a slug, without having to do any other type of research, is seeing that iridescent slime trail that they leave behind. But obviously after a heavy night's rain or rain during the day, you're not going to see as much of that. But that's definitely the true sign. And then also going out first thing in the morning or late in the evening, as soon as we, because we still have light going on to almost 11 p.m. now.
Right.
You can see out there. And if you go out after 9 o'clock at night, you'll start to see the slugs really come out.
And that trail that they leave behind, you know, I was out picking berries yesterday and was finding it on some otherwise really lovely raspberries, and it's harvest time and you might see that trail on some of your produce. Is that harmful? Can you just wash it off? If it's slimed, it's no good. How does that work?
It's not really harmful. You can wash that off. What can happen, though, if you're going out and you're controlling slugs, and some people will just go through, pick the slugs off and squish them to get rid of them, you want to wear gloves.
I can't believe that doesn't go without saying. People do that barehanded.
Yeah. If you're out working the garden, your hand starts to become a little bit of a claw anyway from working with the clay and the soil and silt and stuff. It starts to dry up. Some people are not shy about squishing the slugs, but they can carry parasites and things like that. So there's a chance that it could affect you. But the worst part is probably the gross factor of the slug slime. And you got to make sure that you wipe off the slug slime before it dries or before you start to add water to it. Because what happens is that slime expands and it just absorbs water and it just becomes more slimy if you just try and wash straight slug slime off of your hands. So you want to wipe it off with a rag or paper towel first before you go to wash your hands, because it will just make a frothy, fishy, slimy, sluggy mess.
I had no idea slugs were so fascinating. Gross, but kind of fascinating.
Yeah, they are. They're not everybody's friend, but they're all around us. So I guess they're our frenemies.
So speaking of frenemies, are people having other issues with pests this summer?
They are. You know, we always have aphids. Aphids are around all the time. This year, it doesn't seem as bad because of the cooler weather and the colder winter. But one of the ways people help with that is they'll use ladybug beetles, and then they'll also use lacewings. And so that's a biological control that they can use to release those. They'll release them in their high tunnels, or they'll release them in the evenings around their outside farms and garden areas, and then they'll hold over at night, and then they find the larva of the aphids and the young soft-bodied insects, and then they eat those.
Do they do enough damage before they wander off of your perimeter?
They'll probably hang around about a week-ish.
Okay.
If you release them in the morning on a bright, warm, dry day, they're probably just going to fly away with the wind, but you want to release them in a way. So if you release them in the evening or on a cooler day, they're not going to have the high tendency to fly off. If you're in the greenhouse or high tunnel situation where it's closed in, and you've got screens up, then they're not going to be able to escape. But they do like to escape, so they're kind of a short-term solution. So if you're going to use those, you need to purchase those and actually order those into the state ahead of time and plan to have those every 1 to 2 weeks so that you can really control your aphid problem. The other types of problems we end up seeing is actually the biggest one we're seeing is not insects so much as we're starting to see a lot of fungus, things like gray mold.
Oh.
So we're having a lot of gray mold issues and the mildew that we're seeing because it's been so moist. And so people will use fungicides for that. They will use horticultural or organic oils to help keep down the prevalence of that because it makes a kind of environment that's not conducive for fungi growth. The other thing to do is just reduce the humidity, make it warmer and a little bit drier.
I bet a lot of people wish they could do that this summer.
Yeah. The only one that doesn't work for is our powdery mildew. Our powdery mildew kind of likes it dry.
Okay.
But some people have been having success using one part milk to 8 parts water and applying that, and then also our horticultural oils. And those are like our dormant oils, which actually are petroleum byproducts, like things like mineral oil, or we can use things like neem oil and canola oil, mixed sprays with water, and that will help control that.
And I think you mentioned earlier voles are making an appearance.
Yeah, there's a lot of voles. And so if you've got areas that are heavily mulched or you've got down plastic, they will hide out underneath that. And it creates little escape tunnels for them, spots for them to hide out during the day. And then they'll come out at night or when there isn't many people around and they'll start feeding. And so if you remove those refuge areas, you're going to help control your voles right off the bat. If you do end up having them, then you could set traps where they could walk on. And they do have those traps where they just walk across it. You don't necessarily have to have bait. You can use bait. Things like peanut butter and seeds work well for that, as well as mice. Mice have been an issue in some places too, and there's significant pest of strawberries because they like to go through and eat your strawberries before you do.
Well, they have good taste at least.
Yeah. So will some of the other bugs as well as the slugs.
The one thing we've been lucky with this year is far less wasps than last year.
Yeah, so there's been a lot less wasps this year. The way wasps work is that their queens emerge early in the season and then they start to set up their nests. And then in July and August is the typical time when we see all of the other worker-type wasps out there feeding and bringing food back to the nest. This year, we had a significantly colder winter than we did the year before, and there's been a lot of dieback in the population. And so I actually myself haven't even seen a wasp yet this year. I have seen a few of the parasitic wasps. They're the ones with the large ovipositor on the back end, and they go around and they find things like insect larvae and lay the eggs in there and parasitize them, and they reproduce that way. So I've seen some of those, and those are actually our friends because they're going to help control some of the other pests that we might see in our garden. The ones that you see attacking you when you're outside of your house barbecuing and cleaning fish, those wasps are out looking for things that have sugar and protein out there, and then they'll eat and then they'll also bring that back for their developing young. They're going around trying to find food and they will attack you for it.
I swear I did not have any food, but I've been nailed twice mowing my lawn. I think I just am one of those lucky people that has a holdover nest somewhere, probably in a tree root ball or something like that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and they'll forage out to up to a couple miles or so from their main nest. Probably most of the time they're going to be within a quarter mile. If you're seeing an abundance of them, you're probably fairly close, within a couple hundred feet of a nest. And so we do have aerial ones and we do have ones in the ground. And those are the two main ones you see. So. And last year we had lots of both. This year we have been lucky and not had a lot. But what people can do if they want to control their wasp population before they start ramping up over the next couple years is early in the spring, starting even as early as April and May, you can get those yellow jacket traps that use the bait and scent packets. And so you can use those and that will track the queens and it will catch the queens before they start their new colonies.
Anything else from the world of pests that folks should be aware of?
When controlling pests, just make sure you use all the methods available to you and the ones you feel comfortable with. Always be careful of your children and your pets and just keep your eyes open.
Thanks to Casey Matney for Pest Solutions. If you've got gardening questions, the Cooperative Extension Service likely has answers. Give them a call at 262 5825. After the break, we're going to cook up something that's pretty and pretty good to eat. Stay tuned. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. The fireweed blossoms are climbing their stalks, marking the countdown to the end of summer. But you can stop the clock and preserve a taste of summer by harvesting those blossoms. Rianna Thurman taught a workshop at the Kenai Library on August 17th on how to make fireweed jelly.
The first thing we'll do is talk a little bit about fireweed. You can use the plant at different stages as it's growing for different things. So when it's just the first little shoots coming up, you can just pick those and put them in salads or saute them, and they're really good, and they're good for you. As the plant matures, you can still use the leaves. As the leaves get older, they do get stronger. They're still edible, but they're bitter. So I use the mature leaves, and you can dry them and save them for later. But when I'm fermenting anything, you can put them on the top of your ferment, and that keeps it from growing mold, and it keeps them crisper because the leaves have tannin in them. Yeah. So you can use the plant throughout the whole growing cycle, and we're going to be using the flowers today, the blossoms and the buds. Okay, so what you have to do to start out, you have to make a tea out of the blossoms. And when you go pick your blossoms, it's really super easy. You don't have to be very particular. You can just like run your fingers up the blossoms and grab them all and just get some of the leaves out afterwards. You don't want the leaves in there, but the buds are totally fine for the tea. So to make the tea, you're going to want 2 cups packed full of fireweed blossoms. So that's like a quarter of a bag, a grocery bag full, if you're just trying to get a rough estimate. So 2 cups packed full of the blossoms and 2.5 cups of boiling water. Rinse them in lukewarm water and let them just kind of air dry, put them out and let them air dry a little bit, and then pack them down 2 cups worth and boil 2.5 cups of water. And then you just pour the boiling water over your blossoms in a, you know, put them in a bowl, pour the boiling water over it and let it cool, and then put that in the fridge after it's cooled overnight. And that helps get all the nutrients out of it too, and the flavor. So you strain the blossoms through a cheesecloth or some sort of cloth, and you got your tea. And this tea, you can actually can this and use it later if you want to, or freeze it and use it later if you want to. So we're going to go ahead and start this up, and we're going to put the fireweed juice. So we're going to do 2 teaspoons of lemon juice.
She's making a double batch. For a single batch, it'd be 2.5 cups fireweed tea, 1 teaspoon lemon juice, 1/2 teaspoon butter, 3 tablespoons powdered pectin, and 3 cups sugar.
So we have our fireweed juice, lemon juice, pectin, and this is 6 tablespoons, and butter, and this is just 1 teaspoon of butter I'm putting in right now.
The butter is to prevent the jelly from foaming when it boils.
All right, so this is going to start boiling, and we're going to get it up to a boil, boil it for 1 minute, and then add the sugar and boil it hard for another minute. How much sugar? So for a single batch, 3 cups. For a double batch, we're going to do 6 cups. And if the jelly is not setting right, then we add more sugar and test it to see if it will, if it needs more, it will set up if we add more sugar.
Bring to a full boil for 1 minute, stirring constantly. Add the sugar and continue boiling hard for another minute, still stirring constantly. It's done when the mixture gels to your satisfaction. That's usually when you stir it and the jelly coats a spoon.
So we're just gonna let this cool. And you can also put it in the freezer for a second. To cool it down. Okay, so this will keep in the refrigerator for quite a while. If there's mold growing on it, then you know to turn it out, you know. But if you want to give these as gifts, you're going to need to do a water bath. We are not doing that today. But you just simply, put the lids on, put them in a water bath, boiling for 10 minutes, and then cool them, and they will make sure the lids pop, and then they should be good to go.
You can find this recipe and more information on cooking with fireweed on the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service website, uaf.edu/CES.
All right, well, if nobody has any more questions.
Coming up, there is too such a thing as free lunch. And at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank, it's the freshest meal around. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. The Kenai Peninsula Food Bank feeds more than 11,000 people every year. Most of it is by distributing non-perishable items, boxes and bags and cans of food. Most of the rest is from grocery stores, bread, meat, dairy, and produce that has passed the expiration date, though is still perfectly good to eat. Fresh, regarding vegetables, was a relative term. That changed about 5 years ago when the food bank got a grant to put in a garden and high tunnel. Now they produce and distribute their own food. Veggies so fresh, they came from just a 30-second walk away. It's a bit of a challenge to the budget. The food bank relies on donations and volunteers to make the project work. But garden manager Paul Sutherland says the benefits are many.
To produce your own food, that's kind of our whole philosophy is take care of yourself, and kind of a demonstration of that it's possible to grow your own food. And we do educational outreach through it. We have a lot of groups that come through and kind of show them the possibilities. And a high tunnel in Alaska really, it enhances the growing season. It gives you a little expanded range of what you can actually grow in Alaska.
Michael Stevens takes care of the garden. He's a volunteer with the MAST program, Mature Alaskans Seeking Skills Training. He's got a Master Gardener certificate and ran his own landscaping business in Michigan. He gave a tour earlier this month of the food bank's garden, which has been keeping him plenty busy all summer.
Yeah, to start here, this is lettuce and radishes. The radishes, in about 3 weeks, you can harvest them.
That's pretty quick growing.
Yeah, in fact, you can see that right there.
Oh yeah, there's some red poking out.
Yeah, and that was only, couldn't have been 3 weeks ago we put seeds in. This whole bed was all peas. Now they're getting on the end of their life cycle. We harvest all these and pulled the plants. We've picked probably 4 times from that. We've gotten quite a few of peas off there. We were donated a bunch of tomato plants. These were in fairly bad shape, but we've got them to recover and they are starting to produce. So there's some kale. We had some vine crops donated, and we put them in. They're just starting to do good.
Those look like zucchini?
Yeah, those are zucchini, yep. And, we've had this bed in collard greens for a while, so you can pick them, and they come right back, so you can get quite a few collard greens off of them. These are all beans going up to there. We did intersperse them with some other stuff, like some turnips and carrots. Yeah, we've been picking them already. We've gotten a lot, probably 10 pounds, pretty close to that off of this bed here.
Most of the 40-foot high tunnel is full of what you'd expect to find in a garden, but there are some experiments.
Somebody donated these, right?
Yeah, that's our artichokes. We'll see how it does.
They were little dinky things when we put them in, and they're growing well, but we'll see if we get any artichokes off of them. These are eggplants. They did flower. We may get some. We'll see.
It's been a slow growing season with the wet, cool weather this summer. Most crops have been a little slow to ripen, but there are some things doing well, a little too well.
It literally got, and if you can imagine this, 12 pounds of kale one day, which is like a tub that's stacked up to there. And then a week later, like I said,
there it was again.
Crop. Yeah, so unless you got a lot of people who like kale, it's the only problem is the leaves get so big so fast, you almost can't keep up with harvesting before they get too big to eat.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still steam it or use it as a wrap or something, but once they get that big, they're pretty mealy and bitter.
The outside garden has had it worse from the rain. On the bright side, they haven't had to water all summer. On the not-so-bright side, there have been problems with bugs, slugs, and weeds.
And we have a fantastic harvest of chickweed.
I see that.
I've been trying to keep it under control. I have a little cultivator I can go in between the rows, but that's a lot of picking. My knees aren't that good.
The cauliflower and cabbages are finally getting ripe, and Stevens is already harvesting potatoes. Lots and lots of potatoes.
I've already harvested at least 50 pounds of little baby rods. These two rows are all red potatoes, and I've gone through and thinned about every third one out, and they're anywhere from 2 to 3 inches around right now. Now you can let them grow, get bigger, but we needed to thin them out. So we have those two rows all the way back. And these are California whites. And behind that, there's some purples. They haven't been doing as well. And these are the Yukon golds. And these are we're gonna let grow until they're really big. And at the end where the bigger white flowers are, those are purples. And so we've got 300 feet or more of potatoes.
Once the crops are harvested, they go into the warehouse, a short walk across the parking lot.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
From there, the food bank's Fireweed Diner gets first crack at them.
We do keep track of everything. We weigh it, write down the pounds of what you've harvested, and then it goes back into here. This is the soup kitchen's cooler. So she gets first shot at everything. Any fresh stuff we have, she can use for the Fireweed Diner. After that, it'll either be bagged, frozen.
Brenda Dunn is the chef in the Fireweed Diner.
We've got carrots. We have some turnips and zucchini, yellow squash, just anything that comes out of our garden right now. It makes really good soups. We put it in salads. Like I make salads, and I put a bunch of the raw veggies, you know, cut up fine, put it in that. So salads, soup, that's mostly it.
The Fireweed Diner is open from 11:30 to 2:30. It's free for anyone to come in. And like I said, she's a chef, not a cook. So they do take donations. Say you just want to check it out, come get a lunch and throw down $5. That'd be great.
What's not used in the soup kitchen is available for distribution. Some goes to the 69 agencies across the Kenai Peninsula that the food bank serves, like Love, Inc., the Boys and Girls Club, and senior centers. Beyond that, some of the produce goes directly to food bank clients as part of the Emergency Food Assistance Program. If there's extra beyond that, it's set out on a free table in the parking lot for anyone to pick up. And Sutherland is looking for more ways to share the food bank's bounty directly with the community.
We got to figure out a way to distribute this when it's fresh, you know? So I was thinking, like once a week, a fresh stand that you give it away. This day, at this time, and then we can kind of time it. So, hey, let's pick a bunch of stuff right now and boom. And then kind of make it an event out of it, maybe. Everything here is kind of a work in progress. So there's a lot of different people involved. And you have a lot of ideas, and you just got to figure out which ones are going to work. So it's really a cool place.
The food bank's big fundraiser of the year, the Soup Supper and Auction, is coming up August 26th at Kenai Central High School. They still need donations for auction items, and tickets are still available. Visit kpfoodbank.org or call 262-3111. Next up, dig into local food with the Farm to Table Supper at the Harvest Moon Local Food Festival. The 5th annual Harvest Moon Local Food Festival runs August 23rd to the 29th in the Central Peninsula, with cooking demonstrations, walks to identify wild edibles, keynote speakers, and the food bank's soup supper and auction. It's put on by the Kenai Local Food Connection, all to celebrate farming, foraging, and feeding locally. One of the cornerstone events is a farm-to-table supper prepared with all local ingredients by Chef Willow King.
I guess it's just a way to showcase all of the different lovely foods that are grown around here and maybe bring people together who can have conversations for the forward momentum of the local food movement and community building.
Willow says she started really thinking about ingredients in her cooking when she had her 3 kids. That evolved from trying to hide healthy stuff in various recipes to creating dishes that make vegetables the main star. She's cooked for cannery crews and at farmers markets. She and a partner ran the Where It's At food bus in Soldotna. And now Willow works at the Flats restaurant on Kalifornsky Beach Road. This is her second time preparing the farm-to-table supper for the Harvest Moon Festival. Do you have any idea what you're going to have on the menu?
I have some ideas. I don't like to guarantee things, but we are going to have some roast local pork from Bliss Family Farms. It's going to make the trip up the road to Wasilla and back. Very exciting. We're going to do some grilled veggies, which we're going to talk about here soon. Some roast veggies. I'm in the market for local pumpkins, and that would really expand my plan. So if anybody knows that, contact me. Dessert, apps, some beer and wine of some sort, all of the things.
One of the purposes of the farm-to-table supper is to show how easy and delicious it can be to cook with local ingredients. To make that point, she demonstrated a way to make a quick meal out of a pile of fresh vegetables.
So what do you have going on here today?
Well, we're going to grill some veggies because that's about the easiest thing that I can do today.
That works.
So, yes, I guess all of it's local grown except the onion. But local onions do make me cry. And there are a few floating around, but we don't have one today. And some onion tops or greens. We have some patty pan squash, yellow zucchini, locally grown orange pretty carrots, a kohlrabi from Betty and Dale Coughlin, who grow the best kohlrabi around, and a tomato, which is from the valley. So we're going to just kind of slice these thick-ish and toss them on the grill with some seasoning. Really basic.
Pretty easy for people to do if they come home with a basket of stuff from a farmer's market and not sure what to do with it.
Super easy, actually. I have only come into the grilling of veggies recently, and I will come home from the flats after work and grill veggies.
All right, go to it. Performance cooking.
Oh, buddy. Ooh. So, going to chop the onion in half, set it face down on the grill with some seasoning.
So just in half, you're not gonna chop it real fine?
Nope. They grill up really beautifully. Just if you put the half straight down, and if you put a little salt on it, it'll start to let some of its water out and almost it's not cooking it, but it's starting to chemically alter the food and break it down.
Okay.
Break it down now. I like to slice tomatoes about a centimeter thick, toss those on the grill. I guess kind of the denser the veggie, the thinner the slice, the waterier the veggie, the thicker, maybe.
Okay.
Might be a thing. Generally. And it's okay to leave stems on. If you go to some Ionia cooking classes, which are super great informational places to be, you'll learn that you might want to use the top and the bottom of the veggie so as to get energy from all parts, not just the, not just the fruit, but eat the other stuff too.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to crunch some onions. I've also never grilled kohlrabi, but I think it's going to be really good. It's sweet, and sweet things on the grill are the killers.
So those are getting fairly thin slices.
Yeah, they are. They're kind of dense and almost like jicama-y.
And you're taking off the outer peel?
Yeah, it isn't usually pretty woody. I like to slice things with as much surface area as possible. They don't fall between the grill as much. All right. That's what we're going to do with that for a moment. We're going to toss them in a bowl. We're going to put everything except the tomatoes in the bowl because I don't really want to beat them up. And the greens. We're going to take a little bit of Bragg's liquid aminos or soy sauce if that's what you do. A little bit of Sun cocoa or whatever oil you have. Salt. More salt.
And pepper is the last thing you got in there.
I like pepper, so I put a lot in there typically. Now, I'm actually going to, just because I just wanted to get those kind of soaked in there, kind of move all this stuff around. The salt, like we talked about earlier, starts releasing the water out of the veggies, and it makes them start to break down and also kind of cook quicker because they're already partially broken down. Make sure they're all good and coated, and then we'll go out and start the barbecue. Sometimes I would put some turmeric or something in here, or ginger, or other seasonings that you like. This is the most basic situation. All right, let's call that good. We'll just let that sit for like anywhere from 8 minutes to 2 hours.
Okay.
Or as long as you really feel like it. It really won't hurt it. It will probably cut your grill time shorter the longer it sits in salt. So.
With the veggies prepared, it was off to the grill.
All right. So we're going to start with the onions. And the carrots. The hardest things.
And how hot about should you have your grill? Like just raging or low or somewhere in between?
I would say this is probably a medium high because this grill doesn't cook that hot. I mean, you want it to sear, and sometimes it's almost like, you know, you put a steak on and you think it's all cooked on one side and then it's not. So same with veggies. I like to have it pretty good and hot, but be willing to turn it down in the event that that is necessary. Mm-hmm. We're going to put the kohlrabi on too because it's kind of dense. All right, all we have left in the bowl is the tomatoes and the onions and the squish. And now we're mixing those up to get them all coated with the seasoning.
Smells pretty dang good.
Rockin'.
The kohlrabi, onions, and carrots were sizzling away. About 5 minutes later, the yellow zucchini and squash went on the grill.
I'm also not very good at leaving stuff alone on the grill. I tend to fiddle a lot, so I try to step away from it. Because it takes longer than I think it will. Yeah, we'll just close that actually for a minute. Let it cook. All right, 90 degree turn. Get some grill marks.
After another 10 minutes or so, the first round was ready to come off the grill.
So the carrots are pretty well done at this point, in my estimation. So move them over and make room for tomatoes. I'm going to pile them up, then they can kind of hang out and just keep cooking a little bit, but not a lot.
Ooh, nice grill marks.
Yeah, they're looking good. Yeah, see, the denser veggies don't get them as easy. They really take more patience than I have at the moment. So, ooh, that's a pretty one. Oh, about some time. I think we're just going to kind of think about on top of the tomatoes, actually. Now that I'm thinking about it.
And that's fresh leaf time.
Yep.
So the green onion tops you just dumped on top and then you kind of drizzled the rest of the goodness from the bowl over everything?
Yipper.
And how do you tell when they're done?
Well, the zucchinis are getting kind of soggy, so I would call those pretty well done. That could be done.
It's nice to have crunch left with your veggies on the grill. That's kind of what's great about it. Perfect. You want to eat some?
If that's a yes, tickets to the Farm to Table Supper are available at the Flats and online at eventbrite.com. It's $50 per person, and seating is limited. The supper will be held at 5:30 p.m. August 27th at Diamond M Ranch on Kalifornsky Beach Road.
All right. There is one of everything. Feel free to eat more. Mm-hmm. Oops, I'll give you the fork. I'll take the tongs.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thanks to Willow for a taste of grilling with local produce. For a schedule and more information on the Harvest Moon Local Food Festival, visit kenailocalfood.org. And if you have pumpkins for Willow, you can give her a call at 394-7413. In other local food news this month, the Kenai Peninsula Fair is this weekend at the fairgrounds in Inilchik. The 4-H Junior Market Livestock Auction starts at noon today. For a fair schedule and list of activities and exhibits, visit KenaiPeninsulaFair.com. The Kenai National Wildlife Refuge has a Saturday showcase program at 2 p.m. today on cool facts about quote-unquote boring Alaska plants and animals. And there's a mushroom forest hike at 2 p.m. August 26th. Meet at the Refuge Visitor Center on Ski Hill Road for both events. The Soldotna Library has a program on Alaska herbs for everyday living at 4:15 p.m. today. The Cooperative Extension Service on Kalifornsky Beach Road is offering free pressure canner dial gauge testing from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. weekdays through September 30th. The Farmers Fresh Market is open from 3 to 6 p.m. Tuesdays through the summer at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank on Kalifornsky Beach Road. The Wednesday Market at Soldotna Creek Park is open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. weekly through August. The Central Peninsula Farmers Market is open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays through September 16th. That's in the school bus turnaround on East Corral Street in Soldotna, next to Soldotna Elementary School. And the Kenai Saturday Market is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. through September 2nd in the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center parking lot. The Kenai Food Hub is another way to pick up locally grown produce. Order what you'd like online at kenaifoodhub.org, then pick up your order from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. Wednesdays at Christ Lutheran Church in Soldotna. That'll do it for Kenai Garden Talk this month. You can listen to past shows on our website at kdll.org. We'll be back with another episode in September. Until then, here's a quote from Thomas Jefferson. "The greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture." Happy harvesting!